I'm Marty Moscoen, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Today we spend an hour with poets. Edward Hirsch gives us his take on poems about love, which he explored in his collection On Love. We'll also hear from New Jersey-based poet Gerald Stern, who joined us on the show back in 2003 after publishing his memoir, What I Can't Bear Losing. Stern was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 1990, received the National Book Award for Poetry in 98, and was named New Jersey's first poet laureate in 2000. But first, we'll hear from Frank Sherlock, whose poetry focuses on different communities of Philadelphia. He was a poet laureate for Philadelphia a few years ago. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us today. We're spending time with poets on today's show, and we begin with Frank Sherlock. He was the poet laureate for Philadelphia from 2014 to 2015, and he joined us 2 years ago to read some of his work, to discuss his many books and collections, as well as his late start to writing poems. Let's take a listen. You like to collaborate with people, whether it's other poets or other writers or the Mural Arts Program or here's a documentary filmmaker. What do you like about that?
Because I've always enjoyed poetry as I've never really gotten into that idea of the poet as the solitary, alienated figure.
The stereotype, isn't it?
Right.
In many ways.
And maybe it's just more a matter of personality, but I see it as more of an exchange, and just I think of each poem as a collaboration of encounter, because nobody ever truly writes something all by themselves.
Well, I'd love to have you read a poem, and this is actually one that you wrote at your what is it, swearing in, your inauguration. This is a poem called You Can You, and it's for photographer Zoe Strauss, who's a photographer here in Philly. In fact, she was on Radio Times, had a retrospective at the museum, also had a show that was underneath I-95.
Right. Well, yeah, Zoe had asked me to write a piece about a particular photo of hers that would be in the show, and the one I focused on was a picture of this tractor trailer that was driven into a ditch, and on the trailer it said the words "You can feel good about," and the logo had been whited out and the brand had been whited out, so all I could think of was this line that "You can feel good mm-hmm. about life in this ditch because you know that your future starts here." What do you do when you drive into a ditch but
exactly.
try to get out of it? So I use that as a jumping off point, as a survey of her work. So each of the lines in this poem refers to a different photograph of Zoe Strauss's.
That's great.
You can feel good about I-95 when you take a walk underneath. Feel good about rocking black lip liner. Your shirtless muscle pose is something you can flex and feel good about. You can feel good about life in this ditch because you know that your future starts here. You can. You know you can feel. You can feel good about the love of your life in a snapshot left on a box spring. A gun and a bun in the oven is something you can feel good about. You can feel good about beating the Giants. Yes. You can feel good in the skin you're in, even if it's been broken. You can feel good about the firefighter and the wonder of fireworks at once. Show off your tattoos and feel good. I feel it. Feel good about falling in love without government sanction. Flip the bird to the law and feel good. You can feel good about your wave cap when it's tied just right. Can you feel how good this feels, this blinking sign of redemption? You can feel good about smoking in bed and not waking up in a fire. You can, you. Feel good about dollar magic. Feel good about letting your jewels hang out. Silly string from an overhead wire is something. You can feel good about Froggy Car. Feel good about making love in Centralia. Rome can make you. The Shrimp and Petrofest makes you feel good and hungry. You can feel good about gangster ink on your face. Feel that smooth bicentennial round ball. Go ahead and say it. It's so, so good. Julius Irving. I told you now, didn't I? You can feel good about yours. It's the first one of its kind in the world. Feel good about being young, crazy, rich, flashy. Feel good about the fleur-de-lis. You can feel good about dollar, 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 dollar. Just don't be a pig about it. Couples touching tongues will make you feel ooh-la-la. He wrote dirty jokes in the store of the stars just so you could feel good. Feel him. You can feel good about dignity under the L. You can feel good about half of everything and the half that seems to be missing. Just feel for it. You can feel good about the most that we feared has turned out to be empty and barren. Drinking a Bud can with one pinky up will make you feel pretty classy. You can feel good about feeling like any day you might be a star. Feel good about making out with a stranger on a day that you come out in drag. Some days you feel for the dead, R.I.P. You can feel good about showing your exit wounds because of what you've held on to. Let's feel good and meet me under the overpass because now is the time to be close.
And that's our guest, Frank Sherlock, reading a poem, You Can You, for photographer Zoe Strauss. That's a great reading. And it almost sounds like you were singing it to us. There's a song quality to that. And for something like this, are you scribbling and throwing things in the trash and starting over again? Are you in a coffee shop somewhere? Are you in your room? Are you at a park? A poem like this, where did you write it?
Oh, I have I have notebooks full of fragments and just, you know, there's the moment where it starts to come together and you start mining through the notebooks. And I was going through the photos, so that's how that came together.
What our listeners can't see is how you position the words on the page, literally what the page looks like. Mm-hmm. Why? Obviously, that's important to you, the sort of visual look of a poem.
Right. I'd like to like the idea of the poem finding its own form in a visual sense and in the scoring. In terms of composition, I think of it as when you mentioned music before, there's a composition that, I'm not sure if the logic always transfers, but right. it's a scoring for me, yes.
And does it help you read it?
Yes, it does.
And you don't, and I'm saying this as a compliment, you don't read like some of the academic poets that we know and how they read. And is that that's just not your voice?
Well, I like poems to be enjoyable as well, so.
I think you just said a lot there in that particular statement. You grew up in Southwest Philly. So where in Southwest Philly?
Oh, 65th and Wheeler, which is between Woodland and Elmwood, right. St. Barnabas Parish.
Did you go to
those Catholics in the audience? Break down the neighborhood via parish. But.
Indeed. Did you go to St. Barnabas?
Yes. And West Catholic.
And West Catholic as well. And did you have no poetry? Poetry wasn't part of your growing up.
Not poetry as I know it or as we discuss it now.
But words?
It was all stories. Around. And I was always an avid reader, so poetry just didn't cross my way until a little bit later.
Yeah. Frank, I'd love to have you read something from Ready to Eat Individual. This is some of the poems that came out of New Orleans.
Sure. Thank you. Army Corps of Engineers promised to repair the levees, and they mean it this time. Got it bad, got it bad, got it bad. I'm hot for Reaper. Maybe instead of speculation, we'll design adorable submarines until the job is done. I need to have a conversation with the moon. I see a lot of raw material, but tonight is not someday, and we want the shine to guide us home. We can smell our way through this world if we have to, but why should we have to? Give us what you got. Give us what you got. Mother-in-law spoils the cook-a-bitch a dirt nap. Until that someday, lamp oil is essential as both guide and ritual. Burn that witch Katrina in the bushes in her womb. Effigy smoke can be seen from an airplane unless the shade is closed. Here's to bearing children with helicopter hands. The funky yodel is my snout song howling while you eat into the mirror. Strange grits are stirred through butter with a sense we're not alone. The imaginary friend at your breakfast table is here to keep you strong. There's no tobacco evidence, but there's pipe smell in the shotgun. Much has been made of the subcommandante's eyes, but there's magic in yours, too. A trinity of metals conduct this dull hum of energy, relics of a faith you almost lost. Basta, then basta. Let us be this new city and liberate ourselves. We can swear ourselves into a parallel government while the sun is coming up. I just want to be your companion species, since rulers are for losers. This moment in the history of history, we might climb through the window to coronate ourselves as monarchs of our skin. Call this kiss an insurrection anyway. Sometimes, utopia is as delicious as it sounds. I have located the glorious new capital on the map in the small of your back. There are desire lines, the future stains, at one with the long grains of memory. I want to ring this traveling light for the elder Arturos who said, I'm from the nine and I don't mind dying, and died. Ring. For those in Houston, ring. For those in Salt Lake, ring. For those in denial, ring, ring, ring. And Miss Marva is still having to sing, a change is gonna come. Life begins again on the back porch that saved the gang. Shout this for Diva Lou, G-Rock, K-Dork from the street. What's going on? I don't know. Follow a clue to piety and see if you can come back. We are all dogs and we run together.
Wow, that's Frank Sherlock, our guest. Again, a poem that's just so alive with sound, including the ring, almost like a, you know, like a mantra in a way.
Right, yeah, there's this, you know, the honoring, the suffering, and also it's hard to write a New Orleans poem without music in it.
Indeed, indeed. There's a line in one of your poems, and I'm not sure. Oh, it's from Over Here. You say, it's so embarrassing to be a poet and not knowing what to say. And I wrote that down because I think we, you know, whether we pay attention to poets or not is one side of this story. The other is that poets are supposed to know things that the rest of us don't know.
Right. And I think an important part of being a poet is realizing that there are times when you will not know what to say. And then that begins the search to articulate this thing that you cannot easily say.
That was my 2014 conversation with poet Frank Sherlock when he was Philadelphia's Poet Laureate. When we get back from the break, we'll continue the poetry edition of Radio Times in Review when we listen to my conversation with Gerald Stern. Stay with us. Welcome back to the poetry edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us today. We continue listening to some of my past conversations with poets, now with Gerald Stern. He's had a long and celebrated writing career, and he's received many accolades, including the National Book Award for Poetry and a Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. A Lambertville, New Jersey resident, he also holds the distinction of having been New Jersey's first state poet laureate. He joined me back in 2003 after publishing his memoir, What I Can't Bear Losing, Notes from a Life. Let's take a listen. I'd actually love to have us begin with a reading from the very beginning of your new book.
Okay, the essay is called Sundays. It's what it was like to be in Pittsburgh as a young man, even as a boy, on Sunday in that, what I call Calvinist city. Sundays, where I grew up, were bad enough for their bleakness and oppression, but Sunday was also the day when the battles between my mother and father took place, since it was the only time that my father slept in. Normally, 6 days a week, he'd be up and out by 7 o'clock or 7:30, and my mother would sleep in till 11 or so. The battles lasted for a good hour and a half, say from 10 to 12, and were punctuated by his sighing and banging dresser drawers in their crowded little bedroom, and her talking low and sometimes wailing in her frustration and desperation. The lingua franca was English, though there were some things that could be said only in Yiddish. They kept the door closed. In fact, the battles always started with my mother carefully closing the door and clearing her throat, as if to clear her mind and get up her nerve. Closing their door was a useless and ridiculous measure, for their voices were loud and the apartment was small. It was called four rooms, but it really was three, and by my calculations, it was not much more than 500 square feet. I slept in the living room on a couch, no place for my books and clothes, and wrote and did my homework from time to time on a rickety secretary that sported a small picture of myself, age 11 or so, that I had to either face or slip into one of the tiny drawers when I picked up a pencil, my knees lifting the piece of fake walnut that extended into my stomach, the table of choice thus going uphill, indicating either a great slide into truth or a sudden leap from hope. When they opened the bedroom door, it was as if a two-headed dragon had come out, spitting fire. They never threw plates. That would have been too loving. It ended usually with my father putting on his hat and coat and venturing out, slamming the front door, his stomach empty, his throat engorged, off to the solace of Upper Fifth Avenue and the wholesale houses, open on Sunday.
With those paper-thin walls, what did your parents fight about? Could you ever figure that out?
Well, later on, and I may have mentioned this in one of the essays, later on when I questioned my mother, years after my father had died, and she lived to almost her mid-90s, she said what they argued about was my father going off to the wholesale houses in Pittsburgh and buying clothes wholesale. Really, he paid for them for his various nephews. Hmm. He had 60 or 70 nephews and nieces, mostly nephews. But I think the real occasion was their connection, their sadness, the loss of their daughter, my sister Sylvia, maybe sexual frustration. It was the only day that my father spent at home, and they'd breakfast there during the whole week, and my mother had to interrupt her pattern of sleeping late, eating by herself, and spending the day pulling the hairs out of her chin and talking to her best friend, Pauline, whose phone number I still remember.
But it's so, I mean, it sounds as if you weren't worried that your parents were going to divorce because they did this every Sunday.
Well, they did this every Sunday. It just exhausted me and was a burden and a weight on me. And I begged them not to argue. And I myself would leave the house. Remember that on that day, I was all dressed up, as was the custom, in a suit, a white shirt, a tie, my hair brushed with brilliantine and such. I had no place to go into the stinking air. So it was sad for me, very sad.
Well, you mentioned your father later on in the book. You say several things about him which really struck me. One was, of all my family, he was the one I couldn't bear to think of in the Germans' hands.
Yes.
You felt protective of your father?
I guess I did, and I still do in a strange way. He was the youngest in a very large family. His oldest brother, who stayed in the Ukraine, because my father was an immigrant, came here at the age of 8, the last one to arrive with his mother, as was the custom then, was sort of kicked out of the nest. by his mother and roomed, boarded with his older sisters. He was a kind of orphan, and he had to please everybody. And he was a salesman in his life, but a kind and not a manipulative salesman. And he loved everybody, but he was terrified of controversy, of conflict. And the only person I ever see him fight with was my mother. He loved everybody, and people loved him, partly because he avoided conflict. And I think some of my aggressive behavior, some of my, if you will, violence, comes as a reaction to him, a kind of wanting to redeem him or make it right with him or beg him to face off. My dream as a boy was that we would sit face to face in a restaurant somewhere and eat ham sandwiches and talk about girls and life and money and death and where they came from and this. But he would not really talk. He would get into vague statements about, I read in a magazine that, of course, he never read that magazine. It was a dream, a kind of dream world he lived in. And I felt sorry for him. And I thought, as you, in connection with what you first asked, how helpless he would be were he the same person in the hands of the Germans during World War II. He didn't deserve that.
Right. And you mentioned your sister who actually died.
Sylvia. She died at the age of 9.
And you were 8 at
the
time.
And I was 8. Oh, there's barely a year between us. And she died suddenly of spinal meningitis, which disguised itself as a cold. And they were Americans. They were the first Americans in this immigrant family. And they didn't expect death to enter their lives or sadness or grief or poverty. They were buying into the American scheme of things, of course, which includes death, but not in their view. And it ruined my mother's life, possibly my father's too, and it affected me deeply and possibly is one of the major sources in my own writing.
Well, and you even allude to that. You talk about the various influences, not sure whether growing up in Pittsburgh or not having mentors, as people talk
right,
about today.
Right, I do that in an essay called Some Secrets, right.
But you do feel as if the death of your sister Sylvia had an impact on you.
It did.
It did indeed.
It represented in a very personal way the loss that I wrote about. Now, the loss was of the 6 million Jews killed. The loss was of a real culture for we lived in a bastard culture. Them growing up, I always envied sort of my oldest uncle that came to America, for they were Orthodox Jews and had a complete culture. And we didn't. We had a fake Jewish culture, well, if I may say that, with kindness and love and not to be attacked by my fellow Jews, well, which I don't care.
No,
me freely. Call in and attack me, please.
Well, I guess this gets back to Calvinist Pittsburgh, which is, as you describe, especially on the Sabbath, what was open, what was closed, where
the
you
movies
could go.
Were closed. Oh, there were no movies. Their stores were closed. Of course, we still lived at the tail end of a time when you were supposed to save money rather than spend it. I'm old enough to be shocked, horrified, and amused by our presidents, Republican and Democrats, saying, go out and spend money and let the economy thereby recover.
We were taught to save
a dollar, save a penny.
Well, and I thought it was interesting. Cause
so
I
the
always,
stores were closed. That's so, what I get thrown off by
I know.
Detail. Everything
That's why
was
I'm
closed,
here.
except, and you couldn't drink on Sunday. But the rich took care of themselves, as they always do, for they had their private clubs, and they played golf, and they drank heavily in their country clubs and such. No Jews, dogs, blacks, left-handers, or whatever admitted.
And you remember that?
Oh, I remember it keenly. And I don't let them in my country club.
I can't imagine you belong
Which
to
is in my kitchen in Lambertville, New Jersey.
But you also describe walking around Pittsburgh. I mean, walking a lot. And I think of your poems as being very grounded in place.
Right.
And I wonder whether that began with your observation of the geography of where you live, but also the politics, the economics of where you lived as well.
Yeah, I describe in one of those essays of that it's the last one in the book, that Pittsburgh, where I wrote that essay as a response to having to write an essay about class. And writing class about Pittsburgh, I described, for it's the second hilliest city in America after San Francisco, the streets go straight up, in the winter, we parked our cars at the bottom of the streets. How you could almost, the rich lived at the top of the hills and the poor by the rivers and the dirt at the bottom. And I loved walking through that city. If the people at the top of the hills could have had their ruthers, the whole city would have been occupied by houses and factories. But the hills prevented that. So the very geography, the physiography of the land created what is a fascinating city with the rivers and the mills, which was a fascinating city and still is to a certain degree.
Yeah.
It has cleaned up and quite disgusting now that it's cleaned up.
The vestige is still there. But you mentioned your father and the fact that he didn't fight, I guess, for what you thought he should fight for.
That's right.
But you also describe your own life. And I guess this is pretty true of a lot of kids having to defend yourself, getting into fights, getting
I'm not proud of it and I'm not bragging. And I'm a little embarrassed by it. I'm embarrassed to say that my dear son reads this I don't remember. I'm sure he got into fights when he was in fifth grade and sixth grade. But ours were not fights of children. Ours were street battles.
Right.
People were seriously wounded, almost died. We're talking about head pounding and knives. And thank God the guns weren't available yet. Or they would have been, you know, the weapon of choice. This was serious business, and much of it was ethnic warfare. And the ones I was involved in was between Jews and Eastern Europeans.
Gerald, I'd love to have you read this poem about your sister who you had mentioned earlier.
The poem is titled Peaches. What was I thinking of when I threw one of my peach stones over the fence at Metro North? And didn't I dream as always it would take root in spite of the gravel and the newspaper? And wasn't I like that all my life? And who isn't? I thought of oranges and later watermelon and yellow mangoes hanging from sweetened strings. But it was peaches, wasn't it? Peaches most of all I thought about. And if the two trees that bore such hard little fruit would only have lived a few years more, how I would have had a sister, and that I would have watched her blossom, her brown curls, her blue eyes. Though given her family, she would have been wild and stubborn, harsh maybe. She would be the angry one. How quiet I was. The Chinese grew their peaches for immortality. The Russians planted theirs so they could combine beauty and productivity. That was my aesthetic, too. I boiled my grape leaves. I ate my fallen apples. Loving sister.
That's a beautiful poem. Again, Gerald Stern reading a poem called Peaches about his sister. Do you still think about her?
I do a lot. In fact, I've written a poem recently that, which I can't remember. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember how it was organized, but it's about those peach trees. I always thought of we planted two peach trees in our barren backyard, and they never really grew to maturity until after we left, probably. And I always thought of those trees later as ridiculously, for this is how a poet thinks, my sister and myself. And so I represented it that way in the poem. They were still hard little stones, and she was the peaches, and she was a hard little stone, as was I, when she died, you know, suddenly.
Although it's interesting because you imagine her as being the angry one.
She would have been the oldest one, and she would have been the angry one, and I would have been... I would have been the one who gave solace to my parents and corrected her. And I would have been kind and beatific.
How boring.
And utterly boring. I don't know what I would have ended up being. A dentist, I believe. Forgive me, brother dentist.
But I wonder, because you have said numerous times, and it's certainly here in this book as well, is you didn't have a house full of books. You didn't talk about poetry in your family. You didn't sound like
God,
you had mentors or teachers or that this poetry thing really came from you yourself.
It is true. And I'm not proud of it. It just happened that way. As I started to hear about and read about the lives of my fellow poets, everyone, almost without exception, indeed without exception, had someone, a high school English teacher, a freshman a teacher at college, an uncle who guided them to books or to writing or to thinking. And it was my bad luck that I never had any such person. So I just did it myself. In our house, there was one book that was hidden. It was a book that belonged to my dead sister, Alice in Wonderland. It was actually hidden, for my sister's life was effaced. There were no pictures of her, no memories. We weren't allowed to say her name even.
Really?
All during the life of all the time my mother and father and I were together. That was the only book in the house, except a prayer book in Hebrew, as I recall. And then I bought a few books, and reluctantly I was allowed to buy them. I remember they were mostly about travelers and Leif Erikson, Lieutenant Pike, and such, Vasco da Gama. For some reason, I was interested in that.
Well, it's interesting. A boy who, growing up in Pittsburgh, wanted to travel the world,
right? Get the
right?
hell out.
You write, so many things conspired in my case to provide a world without authority. So it was even beyond poetry. It sounds as if you were left to your own devices to grow yourself
up. As a child,
I
was like, completely to my own devices. I watched later how mothers, fathers operate in the world. And I was so delighted to see that they get gifts, they celebrate birthdays.
You didn't have that.
I'm not saying this with any anger even. They have rooms of their own. They have chests of drawers. They have bookcases. They have lamps. They have desks. They're taken on trips. It's as if I had to be effaced along with my sister so that the Malachamovas, the angel of death, would pass over and not notice me.
Well, that's quite a profound thing that you said. The idea is to almost make you invisible so that...
Make me invisible, yeah, yeah.
Do they believe that? I mean, is this part of the...
I don't think it was deliberate, it was even exaggerated insofar as once a year for 1 week, I got the flu, or the grip, as we called it. And my mother and I was safely ensconced in a bed surrounded by devices to help me breathe, asthmatic devices or anti-asthmatic devices. They were really asthmatic devices.
Right.
And I was fed tea and so on. And then when I got to be 14, I remember this, and when I suddenly grew to my full height and wore size 11 and a half shoes, horrified I was at my feet at 14, I suddenly stopped being sick. And I was not sick anymore. I decided not to cooperate in that. I decided early not to cooperate very much, and not only didn't have authorities, but I was anti-authoritarian.
Is that why you found poetry, you think?
I found poetry as a relief. I drew a lot as a boy, but I don't think I was good enough to be a painter. Poetry, I don't know. I thought that everybody wrote poetry.
That was my 2003 conversation with poet and essayist Gerald Stern about his memoir, What I Can't Bear Losing, Notes from a Life. When we get back from the break, we'll get some more thoughts on poems about love from Ed Hirsch. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for tuning in today. We close out our show on poets and with poets by listening to my conversation with Ed Hirsch. He's the author of 8 collections of poetry, as well as 4 books of criticism, and has authored the Poet's Choice column for The Washington Post. He joined us way back in 2001 on Valentine's Day so we could get his thoughts on poems about love. He compiled his favorite prose on the subject in a collection called On Love, and also discussed his perspectives on love poetry in his book titled How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. Let's take a listen. Is it hard to talk about love poetry on Valentine's Day just because either we're so cynical about love or we're so cliched about love?
I'd never done it before, actually.
Yeah.
I think that you have to get away from the greeting card verse of it. And it's not, I think when you start talking about love poetry as opposed to Valentine's Day sentiments, right, you're going to get poetry with a harsher edge and something more dramatic, sometimes something more blissful or ecstatic. But it's going to be odder and stranger than one usually associates with Valentine's Day.
Do you, though, as a poet, approach love differently than you would insomnia or anything else that you've written about?
A more terrifying subject.
Is it? Why?
A more terrifying. Because
why?
I think there's greater anxiety about it because of the tremendous amount of sentimentality around bad verse related to the subject of love. So I think it has to be approached either obliquely or oddly, or you have to have something really interesting to say, or you have to want to say something about power in relationship to love, or you have to have an extraordinary metaphor. It's an irresistible subject, but it also comes with a big burden, which is there are just so many cliches that haunt the subject. But I can't think of any poet who doesn't, at one time or another, want to say something to the beloved.
But this idea of finding this really powerful metaphor, I mean, it's the job of the poet, of course, to go find language means something.
You have to find language, and in this case, maybe with all poetry, but certainly in this case, you have to clear away a lot of the clutter. A good love poem is not just addressed to one other person. I first picked this up from an essay by T.S. Eliot called The Three Voices of Poetry, where he says that a good love poem, though may it be addressed to one person, is always meant to be overheard by other people. And that the difference between a love note or a love letter, which is really meant for one person, a poem is a made thing. I mean, the oldest term for poetry in Greek is poesis, and poesis means making. A poet is a maker, and a poem is a made thing. And when you're making a love poem, you're making a poem for one other person, but you are also making it to be overheard by other people. There's a wonderful Russian poet named Marina Tsvetaeva, and she said something that had a great impact on me. She said, reading is complicity in the creative process. So it seems to me that if a certain kind of love poem is trying to instill a state of intoxication in the lover or the beloved, it is also trying to instill that state of intoxication in the reader. And it's trying to instill that state through language. You might say that we could speak of poems that want to take the reader or sweep the reader off his or her feet, that want to intoxicate the reader, that want the reader to swoon. In other words, the same sort of state you'd want to instill in the lover, the poet uses language to try and instill that state in the reader.
The kind of seduction.
A kind of seduction and a kind of encounter and relationship that seems to me passionately engaged. What's odd about the reading of poetry, seems to me, and what's very passionate and peculiar about it, is that it's a kind of deeply intense encounter between two people who are not physically present to each other. We have the words of a love poem. We don't have just, you know, smooching, that which is something else, that the love poem uses language as an intermediary. And as it eventuates itself in the reader, it's really meant to instill the most passionate state in the reader, but not by someone who is physically present to you. And I believe that one of the reasons that poetry can deliver on our spiritual lives is precisely because it gives us a gift of participation through language, but also interiority, connection to our own inner and subjective selves. And the gift of poetry, when you read it alone by yourself in the middle of the night, is that you are not just alone with your own feelings. You are alone with the words of another. But those words of another often deliver up to you your own feelings through language.
And do you think of the reader when you write a poem or a love poem? Are you aware of them?
I think you're only aware of a distant reader or a future reader. If you're writing a love poem, you're aware of both two kinds of readers. One, the reader in front of you, and, you know, a particular reader, and then an eventual reader. But I don't think of the reader as a friend who's going to be picking up this book or who you're writing a note to. Paul Celan, based on an idea of Osip Mandelstam, said a poem is a message in a bottle. And he says which is one of the things I pick up in How to Read a Poem, that a poem is a message in a bottle sent out, he says, in the not always greatly hopeful belief that somewhere and sometime it will wash up on land, on heartland perhaps. So my idea is that you have an idea of a reader. That's why you're making something. But the reader is not necessarily someone who's around you in daily life. The reader is some potential reader. And sometimes I think of that reader as the great dead. That is, the poets you want to be among, who you aspire to be among, and you're trying to write something that would be worthy of them. One of the things that I've learned from the Song of Songs, which I think is the greatest love poem ever, is that a religious language can often work quite well in relationship to love poetry, and that it's got the testamentary quality. It's got the feeling of, it's got the passion, it's got the elevated language, and it turns in an interesting way when you take a secular subject and make it sacred.
Well, which is, I think, a perfect sort of segue into a poem that you have written, which is in this book on love, called, interestingly, A Fundamentalist, talk about love.
I wasn't actually thinking of my own poem, but it is the case that I've often turned it that way. And I suppose that I had used, along the lines of the way we're talking, I'd used the Hebrew Bible quite a lot in my poems, and I thought I'd see what would happen if I tried to make a New Testament one. So here it is, A Fundamentalist. It was just a dump, really, a salt-sprayed room in a transient hotel falling into the open sea. But we loved its tackiness, its crippled flamingos and blustering neon sign, "Welcome to you travelers." It was as if we had stepped over the edge of good taste onto a strange peninsula, remote beyond all reckoning, where for 3 days and nights we went further and further into each other, and we did not turn back, we did not turn away. It was not a revival meeting or a snake-handling ceremony, but I'm not ashamed to say, in that dingy room on the edge of nowhere, I learned to pray, to become a fundamentalist of your body. I don't know if I was lost or saved, but it was their love. I felt an angel's possessing grip, the flames rising from your skin, the shadow of the divine. I knelt in a Pentecostal church and spoke in tongues before I was lifted up and carried into the light.
I love that poem, and it's called A Fundamentalist, and it's written and read by our guest today on Radio Times, Edward Hirsch. I like many parts of it. I like it was not a revival meeting or a snake-handling ceremony. Again, the sort of mix of religiosity and ceremony and this notion of being so seduced by love and certainly by sex, which is, I think, what so much of this poem is about.
I'm afraid it is.
and why not?
Right? I think there's something comical in it to me, in that it's so that the fundamentalist turns out to be a fundamentalist of your body.
Yes, exactly.
And the scene is so tacky. But it is transformative, and in some way it really means it.
Right.
In some way it really means it. And so it's playing off the fundamentalists of the revival meeting, the snake handling ceremony, which has got that little bit of sexual turn in it. But I think the turn in the poem is that what seems like it might just be a joke turns out to really mean it.
Exactly.
It really means it.
So you're a believer.
So I'm a believer, exactly. I'm a believer.
And is it true in any kind of way? Again, the sort of, you know, the tacky motel, I'm assuming, hotel, transient, you know, welcome to you travelers.
Yes, the misspelling.
The
misspelling. It just struck me as a kind of memory, how absurd it was, how funny. Misspelling, the excitement of their misspelling. I just thought it would be interesting to use Christian imagery in this way and to see what would happen if you pushed it and to take a sort of squalid scene and say, you know what, it's really transformed into something sacred.
Mm. Mm.
And I think that's something that poetry does. I mean, not just love poetry, but it does take you into a sacred space, and it does transport you from one world to another and to deliver up an asocial bliss. You know, I have an idea about a lot. Part of my idea of love poetry is that most love poetry is unhappy love poetry. That is, most good poetry that's love poetry is the poetry of desire and desire thwarted.
Right. The broken heart.
The broken heart poem is maybe a little more appealing to write and a little more possible to write given the anxiety about the history of love poetry. But there is also something that I would call the love poetry of attainment, where the lover is actually fulfilled. And I wanted to see what would happen if it's almost unrealized in contemporary poetry because it's such a difficult subject. Happiness is much more difficult to write about than grief. Philip Larkin said, happiness writes white. And I wanted to see what would happen if happiness did not write white and if you actually tried to deliver up a certain kind of ecstasy and bliss. And I have found in the chapter you were mentioning about love poetry and how to read a poem about At the White Heat, I try to actually find poems in the history of poetry that actually are poems of attainment.
Yeah. You've also written, and perhaps this is sort of what you were saying here, is that so many modern and contemporary poets are terrified of deep feeling, of seeming undefended and sentimental. This is from How to Read a Poem. So that it's perhaps easier, safer to be cynical about love or to talk about love thwarted than really love exalted.
Or anything.
I
mean, I think the irony is just so great that so many contemporary poets and so many contemporary people feel that they just defend themselves by fending off feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, one of the great gifts of lyric poetry is that it overcomes that. And in a way, the model of the love poem, a certain kind of love poem could be the model for poetry itself, and my argument that it's also possible to have a poetry of attainment, a poetry that instills a state of bliss in you. And many readers and many people are defended against this thing, and yet it's this very intoxication in love poetry, but also in poetry in general, that poetry gives us.
One thing, though, I remember interviewing you about this when I first interviewed you years ago, was you would go to the local sort of fast food joint or something, someplace where the world was.
Yes, well, that's the next part of the thing. That's why I had to. That's why I had to begin with all of this because you remember too well that when the day starts, I like to go out with other people too. And so I go to coffee shops or fast food places or cafeterias, and I like a little bit of buzz when I'm writing. I like a little bit of messiness because when you're writing, you spend so much time alone, and I like to feel that I'm participating in the world as well. At least to get the day started.
Right.
Also,
and is that also to get a poem started?
Right. Well, I mean, getting the day started, meaning to get going on your work and get your writing going.
Right.
Then I also work a lot in the afternoon at home. But I think part of it comes that I spend so much time alone by myself in the middle of the night because I'm such a bad insomniac, that I've done a lot of reading and writing at night. So when the day comes, I like to go out with other people. So I like a certain amount of buzz of other people. You can't be, in my experience, you can't actually be where other people know you. You're not actually,
so you don't go to the library at the University
actually,
of Houston.
You're not actually
something.
Talking. You don't go to coffee shops where other poets are sitting around having conversation.
Right.
That's something else. But for writing, I like being part of the world a little bit, and so maybe the Garcia Lorca quote needs to be modified in that way.
Let me just read a couple of lines, and this is actually from the beginning of How to Read a Poem, and you write, "Read these poems to yourself in the middle of the night. Turn on a single lamp and read them while you're alone in an otherwise dark room or while someone else sleeps next to you. Read them when you're wide awake in the early morning, fully alert. Say them over to yourself in a place where silence reigns and the din of the culture, the constant buzzing noise that surrounds us, has momentarily stopped. These poems," I love this line, "these poems have come from a great distance to find you." The idea that poems seek out their readers.
They're meant for you. They're meant for each of us, that poems don't really exist until we read them, and that they're coming across time and across space and across languages and across geography, but across centuries to find you as a reader, to deliver you up to yourself.
Why do you think Americans are so standoffish about poetry or so put off by poetry, except for, you know, the sort of hardcore group of people?
I think it's changing a little bit. I think that a lot of people are discovering there's something important in poetry for them. The teaching of poetry has been one of the great failures in American education. And I think one of the reasons, I mean, I don't know, it's partially that poetry is not deeply ingrained in the culture the way it is in many other cultures. But also that the way it's been taught in schools has been notoriously unsuccessful.
And that's the sort of rote memorization, I guess, or...
Well, memorization would be good, but the rote part is wrong.
Yeah.
Also, it's that it's a series of rules to be memorized and tested on rather than a spiritual delivery of language. That is in some, I mean, hundreds of thousands of young people encounter poems every year in school. It's not true that they don't read poems. They find them in classrooms. But what is true is that education for them fails because they don't understand what I think of as the first premise of poetry, that it exists for us. The whole history of literature is there for our enchantment. And if you leave a class in poetry and you come away and you realize the poems are for you, I believe the class has succeeded. And so you become a reader. Classrooms are wonderful places to talk about poems, but the poems aren't meant for classrooms. They're meant for readers to live, to realize them in their lives. So these poems have come to find you, meaning you, the individual reader.
Do you think poems are to be read out loud, or?
I think it's wonderful to read them aloud, right. And I think it's a way for us to hear them, and it reminds us that poetry is related to sound, that the sounds of the words are crucial in poetry, and the poems can't. You can't change the language of it. It can't be paraphrased. The great Russian poet Osip Mandelstam said about this, "If a poem can be paraphrased, then the sheets haven't been rumpled. Poetry hasn't spent the night."
Oh, I like
so
that.
It can't be paraphrased. But I would also refer to something I would call the inner ear, that you can also read poems to yourself and feel that you're hearing them. You don't always have to say them aloud. It's a wonderful thing to say them aloud. Mm-hmm. But they can also deliver up their sounds to your inner ear by just being conscious of the words as material entities, not just transparent vehicles of content.
That was my 2001 conversation with poet and critic Ed Hirsch. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits the show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.